Okay. No announcements from Rob. Do you have any announcements? Okay. What I'd like to do this morning is just a little bit different from the usual. I'd like to give an example, take a kind of case history, case study, and show how there are some interesting connections between the humanities and some of the stuff in ethics and very practical problems. In a way, I just wanted to take a break from theory and historical treatment and give a particular example. Some of you have wondered whether the course is practical at all. I think over the long run it's very useful, but in the short run it doesn't always seem to have much practicality. But I'd like to take off from some of the comments that Leo Marx makes that I referred to last week in his fascinating article, Pastoral Ideals and City Troubles, and try to show how they have at least some bearing on a very practical problem we face environmentally. Marx, as you'll recall, points to some of the mainstream of American literature, Mark Twain, Melville, Frost, Hemingway, and others, and suggests that you have this typology of city on the one hand, wilderness at the other extreme, and in between the pastoral or the rural. And he argues that there's a fair amount of evidence that these different areas are appealing when they remain distinct. He uses the image of the machine in the garden and points to the advent of the locomotive. And on the one hand, what a tremendously positive thing this was in terms of transportation of goods and people. But on the other hand, the way it tended to break up the solitude, the quiet, the tranquility of the pastoral scene. And he gives many good examples in his writings. I would like to work with that typology and suggest that it has some practical implications for how we actually arrange the near environment. I've commented before that it's always interested me and somewhat puzzled me why so many of our grad students in natural resources and even many of the undergrads always want to work on the Amazon rainforest or wilderness areas or somewhere in Africa or Costa Rica, but have had over the years relatively little interest in the near environment where we actually live out 98-99% of our lives, most of us. And this has always puzzled me and somewhat disappointed me, because I believe that we are not doing all that good a job in terms of the near environment. In many ways, America is a fairly ugly place in terms of the way urban functions bleed out across the countryside and the way we exploit so much of our land commercially. So I'd like to take a very specific issue that I've pondered for many years and done a little writing on, namely the issue of how we treat land along our primary highway corridors. If this is Ithaca here, and the lake goes up and past the power plant up towards the north end, then you have Route 13 going up here towards Cortland. You have 79, say, going over towards 81. You have 96, say, heading out from Trumansburg and up towards Interlaken and eventually to, if you're going to Rochester, 79 goes over to the west towards Watkins Glen. I'll just leave it for these. 13 would go on south towards Elmira. And a very interesting thing has happened that you're well familiar with, that these arterial roads, I'm not referring now to the interstate, but the arterial roads, the ones that are usually marked in red on most maps, and it's fairly easy to figure out what the key roads are in this case, These arterial roads gradually become developed with private residences, small businesses, small industries, and so on. And after a while, you get the sense, as you do now, say, from Ithaca out towards the hospital and beyond, or say on Route 13, if this is NYSEG, from NYSEG up to Dryden, you have more and more development, and you have a sense that you, in a way, never leave the city. The highway, in some ways, is treated like a city street. It's simply a convenient place to have small businesses and so on. And I'd like to look at a few of the ramifications of the way we do this, which is in sharp contrast to the way this problem is handled in rural England to a large extent, in large parts of Germany and Switzerland and Austria and other countries, where they tend to keep the highway corridors free. They don't allow this type of development along the highway corridors. What usually happens is that the number of driveway cuts increases, the accident rate goes up, eventually the speed limits come down, and the highway becomes not only visually unattractive, but it becomes less useful as a highway. It's less safe, less fast, and so on. The old pattern was, and we see an example of this in the section of Route 13 out past the airport and so on. The old example was you just move over to the side and build a new road, and typically would keep that as limited access. In fact, for 96 here, there already years ago was a road corridor specified in the planning stages in case this was needed. Now, that is hugely expensive economically. It costs a lot of money to build a road like that. It's expensive environmentally because it uses up lots of farmland and forest land and has a very serious impact on wildlife and so on. And it makes a visual aesthetic impact and so on. It's very troubling to the families that are forced to move. Their land is taken through eminent domain and they have no choice in a case like this but to move for the sake of the new road. And I would like to suggest that instead of this pattern here, that it would make a lot more sense to treat the highway corridor itself as a natural resource, as a social and economic resource of considerable value. That is, I would like to suggest that we try to do the kind of thing that has been done widely in some of the European countries, where we limit development severely along our primary highways. Try to push that development into the cities and towns and villages, but leave the highway itself relatively free from development. Now, the way this is done in Europe is very interesting. If you have a road that, say, has some blind curves, otherwise a good road, over the years they'll make improvements in some of these curves and so on, so that you'll get a reasonably high-speed road here. And then a very, very interesting thing happens, that if the traffic still continues to increase, what they do typically, and I've seen this in various parts of Germany where I've studied this, they'll simply move over to the side, add two lanes, and they have something that's a near equivalent of one of our interstates. And this is at extremely low cost because they don't have to buy up a lot of new land. They don't have to force people to relocate their homes and businesses. It has a relatively small environmental impact compared with the way we handle it in most parts of this country and so on. Sorry, I forgot to hit the record button, Greg, but we'll get this. There it goes. I would like to suggest that we look at this problem in an ethical, philosophical, environmental context and see where we may come out. This pattern here that is found in parts of Europe, it seems to me is an incredibly rational way of handling the issue, both financially, aesthetically, environmentally, and in terms of the human costs, because, as I've already indicated, if there are not people living along the road to begin with, if they're not businesses to begin with, you don't have to exercise the equivalent of eminent domain and force people to move. We have not handled it this way, and the results, I think, are not altogether satisfactory. Another reason for addressing this problem is that there are fairly good reasons to believe that over the next three, four, five decades, tourism may become increasingly important in upstate New York. And one of the things that tourists do not like, and there's ample evidence for this. I've had I had one master's student do a thesis on this topic, and others have worked on it at various points. One of the things tourists do not like is to have the sense that they never leave the city. Part of the incredible pleasure of motoring through rural England, of driving through parts of Bavaria or in parts of Austria and so on, is that once you leave the cities and towns, you have this delightful experience of being in the rural landscape with all of the visual attractions of field and forest and the wonderful borders between field and forest, and you're not constantly bombarded with advertising, with small businesses, with McDonald's, and the rest. And it is a pleasure. Now, one of my assumptions in all of this is that for the foreseeable future, we are not going to abandon the automobile. I think the position that we have to think mainly in terms of mass transit and so on, particularly in areas that are not highly populated, where the population density is low, is simply not realistic. Americans love the automobile, as people in most parts of the world actually do. Look at the changes in Europe and even in China now. The curve is rapidly upward. My assumption is that the automobile is going to be with us for a long time. How can we handle problems of transportation and the environment most effectively? And again, let me remind you that one of my basic assumptions, one of my starting assumptions, comes from the Leo Marx type of work, that people find it attractive to have some distinctions between rural city and, at the other end, wilderness. I think this is more apparent to us in the case of wilderness areas, but even in rural areas, people find it more attractive visually and experientially if these functions are kept distinct. Yes?
What about like 81, which is all farms kind of dotted with, you go through small towns,
right,
but they're very occasional.
Right. Of course, we have limited, no development basically on the interstate. Some states permit advertising, but no development. My point is that we simply, neither environmentally nor economically, want to change all these roads into interstates. It's just hugely...
I didn't realize that was an interstate.
81 is an interstate, so there's no possibility of building along the right-of-way and so on. Okay. Now, let me shift gears slightly and give another kind of philosophical, ethical background that helps us think about this problem. And here I draw on a book that was actually published back in 1880, a very, very interesting book with the title Progress and Poverty, by the writer Henry George. Henry George was a printer who worked in San Francisco a fairly successful printer, but he had a very, very active mind that was always wrestling with various social and political issues. And in this book, which had a huge influence in Europe, interestingly, although he was an American, the book never quite fit the mores, the values of Americans who always took more of the attitude, it's your land, you do with it whatever you want. This book was widely circulated, widely read in Europe, and had quite a bit of influence on the way they dealt with land. Henry George put forward the thesis that what he called rental value of land, today we would call it roughly development value, that the and let me use the term development value because it's a little more familiar to us. The development value of land, he argued, is not mainly, in fact, only a tiny bit of it is related to something that the landowner himself has done. There are a few cases where you might have drained a swamp or made some physical improvement. That would affect the development value of the land. But in most cases, what he called rental value, the development value of the land, was a function, is a function, of the larger socio-political economic context. Let's take the land here along 96, or the land along 13 here going south. That land has value because there is a police force, fire department, there are utilities, water, sewer, electricity, there are consumers, there is a labor force, and in Ithaca, to a considerable extent, also because of state and private investment in Cornell. There are a lot of people around associated with Cornell and various industries, so that this land here has value as a function of these other factors. The primary factor, of course, in most of these cases is the highway itself, which was built and is maintained at public expense. Let me give you an example of this more in detail. Before I came to Cornell, I taught for about 13 years at Earlham College, a small Quaker liberal arts college in Indiana, city that had maybe 40,000 people. It was intersected east and west by the old US 40, and then there were some highways going north and south and so on. Here's the Ohio border here, and about 40, 50 years ago, I lose track of the time now, they built Interstate 70. It came in from Dayton, crossed right about here, and went north of the city. And this area here, the scale here is a little off. Richmond would actually be somewhat bigger. This area here would have been about 2 miles. It came to be known as the Miracle Mile because so much business and quite a few fortunes were made developing this land. Now let's take, just for the sake of simplification, let's assume there are originally 4 parcels of land here. There were more than that, but let's just take 4. These were used to build Sears Roebuck, Goodyear, Midas Muffler, a whole range of small businesses, McDonald's, and so on. And it was a very important part of the economy of Richmond, Indiana, the Miracle Mile. Now, let's say this is number 3, that parcel of land. If that parcel of land had been located 3A, 30 miles from any town or city, way out in the boonies, it could have had almost identical physical characteristics. It might have been worth just a tiny fraction of 3, because this land, far removed from consumers and workers and all the other factors, and notably the highway itself, this land simply doesn't have much development value. The land is no different. There's nothing that the owner did differently to the land. It's, as the realtors tell you, it's all location, location, location. the same land in Manhattan that looks physically the same from a piece way out in the boonies is worth hundreds of times as much. Now, according to Henry George, this value, this rental or development value, was created not by the landowner, but was a function, is a function, of police force, fire department, political units, laborers, consumers, and notably the highway itself. Now, if the value of the land for development is created by the public and public investment, and to some extent larger private investment, but not by the landowner, why should all of the value of it, of this development value, be given for free to the landowner? For instance, when the land was rezoned from agricultural to business, why not charge for that rezoning? Or why not put the rezoning up for lease and allow people to bid on it? Or why not lease or rent the rezoning to the person who wants to develop? In fact, this could have had other advantages, because if the city had guessed that maybe there were four areas here that were likely to be developed commercially, they might have put zoning up for lease or bidding and might have determined empirically where most business people thought the best opportunities for doing business were. And it might have been that they would have concentrated here. I think that's likely, although they might have wanted another area too. If they, most of the bids came in here, it would have been possible to plan more rationally for this development, because you would have known what the business community was anticipating. But the major point that Henry George makes is, why give away what is a publicly created value? Now, it's not just that we give away this publicly created value, but in this area, something else happened. The scale is way off here, but let's take these as 1, 2, 3, 4. Here were some people who 50, 60 years ago wanted to get out of Richmond proper, so they went and built homes along a somewhat quiet rural road, somewhat like, say, Ellis Hollow Road or something like this. And then one day they woke up and they heard the noise of bulldozers and earth movers, and a year later they found their quiet patio and backyard was 30 yards from the loading dock of a Kmart. That was not a pleasant experience. They were compensated nothing. It was a windfall for the people who owned this land. It was a kind of wipeout for the people who had built their houses along here. And that happens again across America. People who have the bad fortune of being near commercial development like that often benefit hardly at all. So a windfall and a wipeout, that in itself also seems hardly fair. Now, what I'm suggesting by this is that the whole possibility of regulating land use, say along Route 96 here, in one sense, this should not be a problem, because the value of this farmland along 96 for development was not created by the farmers themselves. So on the one hand, it would seem just and fair simply not to grant them rezoning, simply to keep this as agricultural, and if they can't sell their land for development, tough. On the other hand, that doesn't seem fair, because these farmers made rational decisions 30, 40, 50 years ago, some of them. They knew they weren't doing all that well as farmers in terms of income, but they made rational decisions based on reasonable expectations that when they retired or somewhere along the line, they could, instead of a 401k or an IRA or so on, they could count on selling this land for development. So you have a kind of tension here between the fact that on one level, since they didn't create the development value, they don't really deserve to profit from it. But on the other hand, society gave them reasonable expectations that they would be able to do precisely that and that this might form the basis of their retirement and so on. That in itself poses a very interesting additional question when it comes to public policy. If the state, the county, the various units of government give people reasonable expectations that this is the way we're going to do things, can you suddenly make changes or can you do it ethically when it's going to hurt some people very, very badly? And I think this, in one of the pieces I wrote on this, I refer to an ethic of transition, that it may be necessary in a case like this to find ways of compromising the issue so that society is able to change and act rationally, but without wiping anyone out altogether. Now, mind you, in the case that I referred to here, these people here with our present system were wiped out to some degree. They suffered considerable loss, and indeed, we did some study of that. Their housing prices, the value of their homes went down substantially when suddenly they had all the noise and visual pollution of being 30 yards from a Kmart or an auto Goodyear store and so on. And what I've suggested in terms of compromising this as an ethic of transition is that even though it would be fair in one sense, since the landowner didn't create this development value, to simply refuse to rezone it for business or even for private residences, yet because of these expectations, it seems to me that you have to work out some kind of payment so that they're not wiped out. Now, again, that's a tricky issue, because should you pay at the optimum level that they could develop? Sometimes the courts have handled it this way, and that doesn't seem reasonable either. Or should you pay people, say, along Route 79 that have no reasonable expectation of commercial development anyway for the next 30 or 40 years? How do you handle it? That's a very tough political problem, a very tough ethical problem, and I think the solution has to be some kind of ethic of transition, some set of compromises that do justice to the various conditions that are relevant to the problem. Let me give you an example of where that might have worked. Some sociologists years ago, in thinking back on the Civil War, argued, in fact, a few people had even toyed with the idea at the time, what if instead of fighting the Civil War, the North and the nation as a whole had agreed to buy out the slave owners? Not on the basis that slavery ever was moral, that would not have worked, but on the basis that the nation as a whole permitted slavery and that people had made reasonable investments in slaves, even though most Northerners and many Southerners thought of them as immoral. What if people had worked out some kind of ethic of transition where, say, they would have bought out the first two or three slaves that a person owned at full market value, the next three or four, two or three at maybe 80%, and after 15 or 20 slaves, you wouldn't get any compensation, figuring that you would not wipe anyone out altogether. Now, to some, that sounds really, really outrageous because it seems to somehow condone slavery, but that's not the issue at all. The issue is, how could the nation have made a transition where more and more people were convinced that slavery is fundamentally immoral? How could they have made this transition hurting as few people along the way as possible? And when people have actually calculated what might have been involved in that kind of compromise, it would have looked very, very good indeed. The Civil War resulted in, 600,000 or so killed? This would have been like today if we had maybe 20 million killed in a war, because the population was, I'm not sure of that exact figure, but that was a huge percentage of the population at that time. It would have prevented those deaths. It would have prevented all the fratricidal killing and tension and so on, and would have also resulted in the ending of slavery. And it seems to me that sometimes with this kind of social issue, the purists often actually make it less likely that we're going to find reasonable solutions. So in a case like this, the purist might say, no, this is that person's land. She should be able to do with it whatever she pleases. The purist on the other side would say, no, none of this development value was created by the landowner. She should have to just give up all rights to development without any kind of compensation at all. Those positions, it seems to me, usually result in gridlock from a policy standpoint. What would, I think, potentially work would be some kind of compromise that would recognize the different investments, the different losses, the different gains that people are likely to suffer, and then try in one way or another to make it work. Not a clean solution theoretically, but I think a possible solution politically. So this is a nice example then of where we have a coming together of considerations about justice in terms of land use itself. How is development value created? How should we deal with it? A coming together of aesthetics. People generally don't like areas where urban functions never cease, where there just is a continual barrage of stimuli from ads and signs and stores and so on. People don't like to spend money unnecessarily building new roads. We don't like to use up more land environmentally. Now, why don't we act in a way such as I've suggested? Well, this brings us to another very important consideration in doing environmental management and policy. There are huge vested interests in keeping the status quo. About 10 years ago, just as an example, 12 years ago, I wrote a piece for the New York State Conservationist. It's a kind of popular conservation magazine on this issue. Had all the color photos. They showed me the galley proofs from the article and the prints of the photos. And it was all set to go to print. And basically, the article was censored by someone in the Department of Transportation, the DOT. They basically told the editor of the Conservationist, he shared this with me, that they did not want him to publish it, period. And I think the reason is fairly obvious. The Department of Transportation has a huge machine, a huge bureaucracy that's fully invested in maintaining the status quo. Doing something like this is difficult. There are other vested interests. This would be is a very hot potato to propose politically, because farmers don't like this possibility that they may not get all the value they hoped economically out of their land. And there are other reasons too. So it's a whole set of factors that come together here, and I think as such, it's a wonderful example of how the humanities, ethics, philosophy, environmental concerns, policy concerns, and so on come together. It's actually been estimated by a number of writers, and I think this is probably correct, that if when we built the interstate highway system, if we had taken through eminent domain perhaps 100 to 300-400 acres of land at each of the interchanges, we probably could have paid for the entire system. What happened in the case of the interstate highway system, in many cases, has been hugely unjust, in many cases borderline illegal, if not downright illegal, because individuals, individual developers, land speculators, got wind of where the interchanges were going to be. The knowledge was leaked from some of the planning offices and so on. They went out and bought up land on the cheap from farmers, and then as soon as the route was announced, the road was built, this land may have increased in value 20, 30, 50 times in some cases. Huge fortunes were made because of people who knew where the interchanges were going to be, where the route of the road was going to be. And in most cases, in many cases, the farmers themselves didn't make all that much money. In some cases, they did. But probably the entire cost of the system could have been paid for by using the development value that was created by building the system itself. And instead, we did not do that. We let the land speculators profit from this, and the taxpayers paid for the system. That, it seems to me, is fundamentally unjust, and creates all kinds of additional problems. Let me pause here a little bit and get some reactions from you, and then I have some other things to say if there are no questions. What are some of your reactions or questions? Yes. Right. I have looked at that, and I've also looked over the years at some of the ag district programs and so on. Some of the ag district programs, and they vary in different states, some of them are not very effective at all, because even if you knew you wanted, say you had a 1,000 acres out here somewhere near Trumansburg, and you knew you wanted to develop it at some point, in most states, you would still be better off to put it in an ag district for 10 or 20 years while the economic situation matured, and then take it out and pay the penalties. You'd still be better off than if you had not put it in an ag district. Most of the ag district legislation is not all that effective over the long run. And the easements, part of the problem there is they're staggeringly expensive. There's no way we can preserve highway corridors if we pay each owner at the maximum potential value for development of the land. I think to some extent the courts have gotten it wrong. I did a seminar one year on land use and legal issues, and I think the courts to some degree have it wrong on this, because they have never really seriously, I think, reflected on the arguments made by people like Henry George, that the landowner himself does not create the development value, thus on one level ought not to be entitled to reap the full benefit of it when the land is developed. So, yes, I have looked, and Chris Nill, who did a thesis on this, looked extensively at some of the easement approaches and so on. I'm not totally against them, but they're never more than a Band-Aid because they're prohibitively expensive. And they really don't solve the basic problem. They add a little green area for particular communities and so on, but on a larger scale, they don't deal with the issue.
What I really wanted to know is how landowners were actually reacting to the proposition of conservation easement, because it's sort of the same principle, not in the outcome, but you're asking the landowner to take the land and put it into, generally, a lot of conservation easements are less than the actual development value that they would get.
Somewhat, right. And they get other benefits. And sometimes conservation easements, I think, are really unethical, because sometimes quite wealthy people will put 1,000 acres or something in a conservation easement. Oh, that's wonderful. I mean, they have like living next to a park and they don't pay any taxes. This is great for them. And I'm not sure that it always is that beneficial to other people unless they have full access to it and can actually use the land, which in some cases they can't. So these are very, very complex issues. In general, I don't think we've been handling these problems very well, and as I say, mainly because we haven't dealt with the underlying philosophical issue that Henry George proposes in Progress and Poverty, that is, who creates rental or development value to begin with. Yes, mm-hmm. Nice and loud. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very complex issue, and I don't fully know the answer to that. But the whole arrangement with the unions, the arrangements with the contractors and so on, let's say just recently, within the last 10 years, between Ithaca and Watkins Glen, they did some pretty extensive road work, taking out a few of the blind curves and improving the road quite a bit. Or about 10 years ago on 79, about 2 miles out of town, they did some work there with the culverts and so on. All of this involves a lot of money. We put millions and millions of dollars into improving these roads, and that's big business for contractors, unions, and these are often tied up very, very closely with the DOT, who have planners that are hired, and they're not planning to do it this way. They're planning in the old way, and they just don't seem to want to change. And there's enormous pressures on them not to change, as best I can understand. There's a huge amount of money. A nice example of this was about 8 years ago, they built a new entrance to Robert H. Treeman State Park. The old entrance was absolutely satisfactory. It was right at a curve in the road, but there never were any accidents because he had good vision both ways. They spent close to $500,000 on that stupid new entrance. Lots of asphalt and so on. The park ranger at Treeman, I talked with him at some length, he was just livid about this. He said the trails, the beautiful stonework, the ecology of the park is falling apart. We desperately need this money. And yet they put it in an entrance, a new entrance that nobody wants or needs. Why? Well, the way bureaucracies work, they probably had an extra $500,000 in the highway development fund for that year. They want to spend it, you know, because they don't want to give it back and have a lower budget. And so you do these kinds of things. It's one of the reasons why, in many ways, some of the political conservatives, I think, on this point sometimes have a lot to say, because private business can't afford to do that kind of thing. Private business has to be more efficient or they go out of business. But bureaucracies, whether it's public schools or the DOT or all kinds of public bureaucracies, they thrive by being inefficient, because that gives them more jobs and more budget and more longevity and so on. You don't want to solve certain problems because you go out of business then. It's one of the problems that we face in the public sector. And this issue is being wrestled with all across Europe and America. How much do you privatize various functions because it's more efficient?
Thank you.
tough issue. These are very, very difficult issues with a lot of vested interests. So it's probably not a very satisfactory answer because I'm not an expert on a lot of that aspect of the problem. But from talking with people who are experts, that's about the best I can do. I think the situation would be something like that. Yeah, Rob, you're in planning and so on. Any reactions?
Well, a couple. One is, and to extend on your answer, I think you touched on what you stated, that it's a question of culture almost. Within the DOT, they're really not the Department of Transportation so much as the Department of Highway Construction and Maintenance. And even though pedestrian or light rail or something would fall under the notion of transportation, they really don't see that as being their function. They see their function as being road builders. An example is the state of New Jersey's Department of Transportation. Has one half-time person that works on pedestrian and bicycle issues, and then thousands of people who work on road construction.
Right.
So you can see which direction it's going. One way that one state that has done something kind of experimental is Maryland, who, queuing off your notion that it would be far too expensive to put easements on the entire corridor, instead of just said, we will no longer pay. We'll build a road, but we won't pay public funds for sewer or utility extensions. And you're free, like you said, free to go ahead and develop your land. It's your choice. It's your land. But if you want to do that, you have to pay for the sewer extensions. You have to pay for the utilities. In other words, you have to take on what would be your incremental gain.
Right. And that would partly resolve, that would contribute to it. Now, another nice aspect in most of the U.S. in contrast to Europe. In Europe, farmland and so on is so scarce that they in many cases put enormous pressure on people not to spread out across the countryside with private residences. We don't need to do that. We have so many tertiary, secondary roads, paved roads, in a county like Tompkins County, that we can continue to allow anyone who wants to live in the country to live in the country. Although I would argue we shouldn't extend sewers in every case and so on, let them pay some of the costs themselves. But we can preserve the arterial roads without denying people the pleasures of living in the countryside. So I think there we have a huge advantage over Europeans because we don't have to take such draconian measures as they do. Other comments or yes?
Mm-hmm. Loud?
Mm-hmm.
Sort of seeing this as the benefits go one way to the business owners that are using the, I guess, institutions already set up. But how do you argue for the benefits provided? Like, we all, you know, need access to, or need these stores to be there, or something like that.
Right. I think there, you simply put pressure on people locating the stores and so on in the towns and villages. Now, there may be extreme cases. I can conceive of some place out in Nevada where it's 120 miles between towns where you might allow a gas station or something. But I think there's no reason why you can't do what Europeans have done, put pressure to have these functions mainly in the urban areas. Yes?
Mm-hmm. I have to agree that a lot of the time businesses just seem to buy land and use it for no reason other than to buy land and use it. Like, we had both a Home Depot and like another big construction store, and the one went out of business, and the other one was building a completely new building.
Sure.
The other one empty.
And that has to do also with tax write-offs. If you allow business people to depreciate a building fully, say in 18 years, or I don't know what the current figure is, we've raised it some, you can afford to do that. On the other hand, if you couldn't write off a building in less than 40 or 50 years, you'd put a lot of pressure on them to take better care of them and so on.
It just leaves so much suburban sprawl.
Right. No, there are many, many ramifications of this kind of issue. My concern is simply that I think we need to begin to talk about it and look at some of the other options rather than simply being locked into the status quo. Okay, thank you.